Good morning, Your Honor. My name is Michael Avakian, and I represent Pizzeau Construction Company. This case is one of the more unusual ones coming up to the court from the NLRB, as in many respects there's issues here dealing with the standard review and exactly the types of burdens of proof that were or were not met by or ruled upon by the ALJ in the initial hearing. It's clear that in the substantial evidence review that this court will undertake, that it has to look at all the evidence in the record and determine whether the board actually reviewed all the facts, considered all the facts, and considered all the inferences from the facts. And if it has not done so under Allentown Mac, then the board's decision needs to be vacated. In addition, there's a very strong principle in this court that the board needs to follow this court's precedents. What we have here is a situation where, although it's a discharge case, the standard review that was supposed to be undertaken involves the right line test, which has been around for a long time and has affirmed by the Supreme Court with some additional explanation of how the burdens are to be carried. But to be simple about it, it's a burden of proof and preponderance of evidence test that the board must meet in order to shift the burden of proof to the employer to establish a non-discriminatory explanation for what he did. So in the first instance, the general counsel of the board would say the employee is engaged in union activity, the employee has been affected by a disciplinary action, and somehow the union activity motivated the disciplinary action. Now, this court has, in cases such as the Sam's Club case cited in the brief, TNT Logistics and CWI of Maryland, has indicated very clearly that the burden is on, does not shift to the employer until there's an establishment of a connection between and a substantial motivational connection between the disciplinary action that's been undertaken and the union activities that occur in the case. What we have with William Imbrino is really a clandestine type of operation that he's undertaken, not even so much different than the activities in the TNT case. Specifically, there was a union election at Pizzeau Construction in July of 2008. There was a certification of the election, but Membrino did not take part in the election. But during this period of time, he had problems with his pay. He had been his pay had been on a salary basis and had been reduced to an hourly basis. And as his hours started to go down, as the economy started to suffer in the year 2008, he started complaining directly to the president of the company that he wanted to be put back on salary when the Maryland Department of Labor had ruled that he and others like him could not be placed on a salary basis under the Maryland wage laws unless he was engaged in supervisory responsibilities, which he was not. And Mr. Pizzeau told him so. After the election of the union, at Pizzeau there was a discharge of up to 60 employees that were laid off. By September of 2008, if I can refresh your recollection, Wall Street started to collapse. And the administrative law judge even indicates in his decision that in the fall of 2008 and 2009, the American economy was in a very bad state. So we get up to September of 2008. The union's been certified for about almost two months, and they have a meeting on September 30th of 2008. Membrino attends and tells the union representatives there that he needs to get a raise and he deserves a raise, and secondly, he was not getting paid enough for travel time, which was a period of time when he perhaps would take a truck to a job site. The union told Mr. Membrino at the hearing, or at the meeting rather, that they were going to inform the employer and the employer's attorney of what was being told to them at the hearing. And they told this to Mr. Membrino, and that's in the record. Well, mysteriously, in the ALJ's decision, there's no information about this exchange and direction and directive that the union officials told Mr. Membrino that they were going to report this to the employer so they could take whatever action they felt was appropriate. And there's a letter and email from Mr. Bonilla, the union business agent, which is in the joint appendix, which indicates that is the actual email to the union attorney from one of from forwarding a, an email from his own business representative about the meeting. We get to the question of I was talking about the standard review initially, but I did want to get to those at least those facts, because they are critical to two of the issues that the ALJ finds. One is that he finds the prima facie case met simply because Mr. Membrino was told that he was going to have to park, he and the only other people, two dump truck drivers that were working at a dedicated site off of Route 236 in Maryland, in Prince Frederick County, had to leave their trucks there. And that in itself, because he didn't have all other trucks that the company owned dedicated that to that job, that were not dedicated to that job site, sent overnight to that job site, were, was now sufficient evidence to surpass the prima facie case. Well, the next piece of information that comes is that Mr. Membrino activity is then reported to the employer by one of the employees who was in attendance. That's Mr. Maltz. And that is the extent of the company's knowledge about any activity that Mr. Membrino was engaged in at that point in time. And then in September, on October 13th of 2008, about 2 weeks after the union meeting, Mr. Membrino walks into the president's office and tells him again he wants a raise. Now, one has to remember that the union is a certified bargaining representative. And under longstanding case law in the United States Supreme Court, the J.I. case and Emporium Capwell, once that happens, individual bargaining by employees is not protected activity, for one. It is in denigration of the union's certified bargaining status. And thirdly, because it's not protected, the employee could be fired without recourse at that point in time.
One of the charges, and I guess this is what you're talking about, is under 8A1, creating the impression that the employee's union activities are under surveillance when Pessoa questioned Membrino's presence and questions at the September 20th meeting. And I'm not quite understanding how your argument, which I'm assuming that that's the charge that you're addressing, how that goes to the argument. Apparently, after the day after the September 30th meeting, Mr. Pessoa asked another employee whether Membrino attended the union meeting. The employee responded affirmatively, and when Mr. Membrino asked about becoming a salaried employee, Mr. Pessoa told Membrino that he heard someone was at the union meeting requesting pay for travel time. So it's in that context that it came up. So, but I'm trying to ground what you're telling us in the charge that I assume that you're addressing, but I'm not
because
sure.
that is the tripwire for the find, I believe, for the finding of the other charge, because we don't really know, because the ALJ did not specifically apply the right Ryan standards as he went piece by piece through the case, and the board just sugarcoated it and said, as far as we can see, in footnote one of the board's decision, what the ALJ did was consistent with their principles. Well, and I don't believe so. But getting back to the point, Judge Duncan, that you just asked, what Mr. Pessoa was relaying to him was exactly what he was told by the union. The union told them that somebody had raised raises and travel pay to him, to the union folks at the meeting, and the union told Pessoa Construction that if people are due raises, please give them to them, or if they're due more travel pay it, and we have no objection to that. And Mr. Pessoa was just relating in the context of another time when Mr. Membrino came unannounced into his office and asked for a raise, what he had also heard about raises and travel pay. And so that occurs at this point in time. And in this court's own jurisprudence in the Denver Crossing case cited in the reply brief, the mere fact that the employer is restating something that he has heard is not sufficient to find a surveillance claim. And so that's why that understanding is important. The ALJ made no mention in his decision about the fact that why Mr. Pessoa said it or how he could have, how he might have said it. And that context is very important here. I need to move on to the actual discharge decision, because that's really based upon the fact that Mr. Membrino damaged a company vehicle. The company had clear policies, and they're stated in the handbook at various pages, 163, 162, about damage to property. If one damages a company's property, they are subject to discharge. During this, I don't think anybody has a problem with that statement, but the ALJ went further, and he determined that Mr. Membrino was, one, he never determined he was at fault. That was for the company to decide. And he never determined that what Mr. Reno was doing was unsafe, which was for the company to decide.
But in your brief, it's very unclear to me whether or not Mr. Membrino was discharged for the damage that occurred when someone else backed into him, or whether he was discharged because he didn't report to Mr. Pessoa after the accident.
The record is unclear because the ALJ doesn't make it so clear. But what is clear is that Mr. Pessoa reached...
No, it was your brief that was unclear.
Oh, I'm sorry. That would be on me. What should be clear is that Mr. Pessoa reached out to an employee to report back to him, to tell him what transpired, because the written documents were not enough for him to make a decision. He had specifically asked Mr. Infante to have Membrino come up. Mr. Infante did so. Mr. Membrino says Infante did not tell him to do that. And we have a number of credibility issues. But the first thing Mr. Pessoa tells Mr. Membrino when he finally gets him on the phone through a third party is, why didn't you come and report to me? I believe it was in combination with the actual damage to the truck, which exceeded the insurance coverages of the employer of $5,000. We were talking to up to $8,000.
There was evidence in the record that it was the truck repairs were done by Pessoa at a cost of a little over $500. And it also appears in the record that other employees were allowed to work off their damages through paycheck deductions. Mm-hmm. So Mr. Membrino's argument would be that he was treated differently. Not that there isn't a policy of discipline.
I understand
damage,
that.
But it's that he was treated differently from others who breached the same policy.
Well, that's one of the key questions. Are the comparators the same? Because the damage to the truck, the hood itself cost over $5,000. This is September, October of 2008. There were no jobs available. There was no money coming into the company. Mr. Pessoa was not going to go out and buy a new hood for that truck, but he was going to do it, so prepare it sufficiently so it could stay on the road, and that's what he did. The judge, ALJ, admitted that the value of the truck diminished as well. So, but the comparator for Mr. Pessoa's discharge is what happened to people who exceeded $5,000 in damage, which would force him to go to his insurance company for coverage, and those are the Capettas, the Branhams, and so forth that we cite in the brief, which the ALJ refused to acknowledge because he found that they had not worked for Pessoa Construction long enough. Now, the arbitrary nature of that, even that piece of the pie, which is that it was that now persons of longer employment have less applicability of the handbook to them and can more freely damage company property is nowhere cited in the record. And that's another one of those problems that we have with considering all the evidence. You have to have a comparator, the CDL drivers, not the operators of equipment, not some pickup truck driver who happens to damage equipment. And I think that's the analogy comes closer to the TNT perspective, where you have very little union activity, obvious on the record, and you have damage to company property. And the final straw in the TNT case was a $32 item. But I think those are the comparators you need to make. You need to look at CDL drivers, not the whole universe, because they're different. They have license requirements, and they have other requirements that they have to go by. The anti-union linkage. Again, Mr. Pessoa engaged in almost no activities on behalf of the union except for the attendance of the meeting. And as far as the Pasola Construction knew, that's all he had done. I see my time is up at this point.
You've got some time reserved.
Let's yes, I do, and I want to reserve that.
Good morning, Your Honor. David Seid from the Labor Board. Two initial points. With respect to the proper standard to determine whether there's unlawful motivation, that was clearly set forth by the Board's decision at page 19 of the record, in which it set forth the right-line standard that the General Counsel needs to establish, that union activity or protected activity was a substantial or motivating factor in the company's actions, and then the company needs to show by preponderance of the evidence that it would have taken the same action otherwise. And then at pages 22 and 23 of the Board's decision, the Board clearly walks through factor by factor as to why ultimately the discharge was found to be unlawful. And with respect to the discharge in particular, circumstantial evidence of unlawful motivation was found from several factors. Mr. Mimbrino attended the first union meeting after the election. It was an election. It was a meeting where he took an active role. Essentially, he was the only employee to raise issues and concerns that the employees had with the company, namely about travel pay. The very next day, unsolicited, President Pessoa asks employee Moltz whether Mimbrino was at that meeting. Then Mr. Mimbrino is discharged within just a few weeks after the election, after there's also the unlawful creation of the impression of surveillance. And there's also disparate treatment in the way that he was treated compared to other employees. And with respect to the company's obligation to show by preponderance of the evidence that it would have taken the same action absent Mr. Mimbrino's protected activity, it's not what company counsel just alluded to at argument this morning as to what he thinks were the reasons for why Mr. Mimbrino was discharged. It's up to the board to evaluate the evidence that was presented to it at the time by the company at the hearing. And what were the factors and reasons given at the time and given particularly to Mr. Mimbrino at the time of his discharge? Here, Mr. Mimbrino was told that he was discharged for failing to come to see President Pessoa after the accident. The credited testimony and the weighing of the testimony by the board found that policy simply didn't exist. And with reference to the claim that he caused $8,000 of damage, that reason was not given to Mr. Mimbrino at the time of his discharge. And as set forth in the board's brief, the board's decision, the damage was repaired in-house for $500. The estimate of the damage was not received until 5 months later. And when President Pessoa was specifically asked why that estimate was received, 5 months later, at page 337 of the appendix, he could not give any reason. And then he was also asked about the resale value, because there had been an allegation in the company's brief that it had affected the resale value. Yet, Mr. Pessoa again was asked at the hearing about resale value, and he acknowledged that pages 335 and 336 of the appendix, and this is in the board's brief, that the resale value meant nothing to him because he buys trucks to use them. So very simply, the board did what it does in a typical discharge case. It weighs the evidence, found here that the general counsel set forth that the union activity was a substantial or motivating factor based on the variety of factors that it typically examines, and then it examined whether or not the employer had shown by preponderance of the evidence that it would have taken the same action otherwise, and based mainly on credited testimony of which the company has shown no extraordinary basis to reverse those credited findings, found that Mr. Mimbrino is unlawfully discharged. And unless this court has any questions, the board would simply ask that this court enforce the board's order.
Okay, I think we understand your position. Mr. Avakian, anything in response?
There's a couple points made. By my brother's statement. First of all, Mr. Pessoa asked the question of Mr. Moltz at the day after the hearing, or day after the union meeting, in the lunchroom where Mr. Pessoa was eating lunch. Moltz came up to Mr. Pessoa and asked him, or told him, rather, that he attended the union meeting. At that point, Mr. Pessoa asked the question, and that's the only thing he asked. Now, what factors were given at the time of discharge? Mr. Pessoa told Mr. Membrino, and it's not disputed, that why did you not come to report to me? And Membrino tells him, no, apparently nobody told him to report.
It seems to me, counsel, that you're just sort of trying to re-argue the evidence before the ALJ, but the ALJ is the fact finder. Is there any principle of law that's involved here? Because it seems to me we're sort of deep in the weeds in terms of facts, and you know that's really not our function. Right.
Well, I do think so, because it comes down to the credibility determinations that need to be made. For instance, the ALJ...
If it comes down to the credibility determinations, that's not our problem.
Well, it makes a difference if the ALJ does not describe why he's making a credibility ruling, because then it's no ruling at all. He's got to state the facts, which come into the preponderance of evidence test and the Allentown-Mack requirements, because unless the ALJ treats all the information in the record, including adverse inferences that can come, and my main argument, I brought out the one dealing with the union's notice to the employee in writing as a record evidence to Mr. Pessoa about what occurred at the union meeting. Now, the ALJ did not even discuss that point in the entire opinion, which I think is critical, because I think that's a trigger for him finding other things. And that's why we don't even get to the shifting of the burden of proof, because the ALJ could not match up the actual union activity of Mr. Membrino with the damage to the truck, because it's got to be a connection between the union activity that triggers the adverse employer action. Mr. Pessoa didn't tell Mr. Membrino to do something to wreck the truck, or to even to position the truck in a position where it could get, and that was the critical factor that Mr. Pessoa addressed with Mr. Membrino. Why did you park the truck there, even if you were attempting to help change the bucket, which nobody had ever seen anything done like that before? And the fact that there are witnesses by the general counsel who could address some of these questions, like, did anybody else ever help change a bucket, and never asked that question, has to be an adverse inference that it never occurred. And whether or not there was a blind spot, Mr. Membrino saw Mr. McCain's report that Membrino had parked in a blind spot, and that never came up until way later in the case. The last point I'd like to make is that if we are going to have reasoned decision making by the NLRB and standards that practitioners such as myself and the public can rely upon, then the board has to impose on its ALJs and itself the requirement those standards of right line be actually addressed. Because at the end of the day, we're left with the admonitions from the Supreme Court and Transportation Management and in Allentown-Mack that substantial evidence of the record requires that all facts be considered by the board and that all the adverse inferences also be dealt with. And unless that happens, we do not have reasoned decision making. If there are no other questions, I'll...
Thank you, Mr. Vakian.
Thank you.
We'll come down and greet counsel and then go into our last case.